Good morning. Repairs to the parks in the Iao Valley damaged by last month's rains is raising eyebrows. Some say the work could reshape the Wailuku River. There's also concern that more damage is being done by people coming into the area. We'll talk with Maui Councilwoman Ellie Cochran. And overcrowding in an Oahu high school is the basis for a class action lawsuit. We'll get an update from Representative Bob McDermott, who joins us later this hour.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and Big Bad Voodoo Daddy is in town, a band that combines swing with showmanship, taking us back to the heyday of Cab Calloway and the swing era masters.
It's October 20th, day 9 of our fall pledge drive. That conversation and more coming up right after this news. Emergency repair work to Maui's Iao Valley parks following last month's flooding is causing consternation for an environmental group. The concern is that the work over the next 4 to 6 months might realign the Wailuku River and in so doing change the topography of the area and cause runoff. But how much has already been changed by the flooding and how much of the concern is based on issues of water rights? Maui Councilmember Ellie Cochran is on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, so, not a problem.
It's been a couple of weeks now since we began to hear of the controversy over how the emergency work might be handled. How do you address those concerns that have been coming from the community that somehow this is going to cause even more damage?
Yes, thank you. I've obviously been trying to reach out to the entities that hopefully can shed more light and answer those questions. From CWRM, Commission on Water Resources, and our administration, Public Works Departments, Parks Departments, whoever's had a hand in the work being done, Wailuku Water Company. And unfortunately, not everyone has been in dialogue with one another, and it's sort of a, I'm not sure if it's a free-for-all, but, just kind of a non-collaborative effort happening. So the questions are still coming and answers are far from forthcoming. And so it's very difficult for me to relay a solid message to the community and address their concerns at this time.
Given the fact that you've just said that people seem to be operating in their own little spheres with not a whole lot of collaboration, should parts of these projects be going forward until there's a full understanding of what might happen to the river and to the area in general?
Yeah. No, I don't. I think things should cease as they are and everyone come to the table and figure out what exactly is going on and address the concerns that the residents and, anyone involved alike at this time. Because continuously, every day, I'm getting bombarded with questions from the outside. And I did recently speak with Public Works, but still, no answers, no straight, direct answers.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is also involved with all of this, and there's been some concern that, boulders are being removed and ground into gravel, that people are coming in there and feeling quite free to take, souvenirs and pieces of this. How do you shape this so that you don't have people feeling that this can be a free-for-all?
Unfortunately, it's not just my call on that. If it was, as I said, I would just cease everything and just clear the air, figure out what exactly is going on. But at this time, we're trying to hold the people accountable for who did bring out the boulders, where have they been put, what have been done with them. And currently, there's a family who had a threat of a court order on them to ask to remove boulders and shuffle them around. They said, bring back what you took out. Why are you asking to rearrange what is here when you took tons and tons, truckloads away, and no one knows where or why, and you said you're going to bring it back, and now that's not an option? So there's, those kind of questions continue to linger.
There's also the question of, do you really rebuild this in the way that it was before because there was so much damage and it's just almost like asking for it again?
Well, I think the way it's been done, I'm not an engineer, but when you remove and clear out the stream bed itself, the force and energy and velocity of the water that will come down after within the next rain is going to be that much more damaging. It'll continuously erode the edges and cave things in. So I understand the vetting up or, you know, shoring back and stuff, but there's existing rocks there to do that, and the ones that they drug away can be brought back for that. So, you know, that's the work that I think people would like to see, and it's happening slowly, I think is the thing.
In a way, that might be to your benefit, given what you said a little earlier about wanting to, you know, stop this until all parties can be brought to the table and
right.
a cohesive plan can be envisioned and then put into action. But now, with so much chafing among so many people and also a situation that needs fixing, do you see that this is going to go well beyond the 4 to 6 month period that we've been told that it's going to take to be able to fix the park?
Yeah, the park itself?
The parks and especially the river, the whole project.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I believe so. But, you know, the unfortunate thing is that up above, Wailuku Water Company around their diversion has went straight forward with work and had trenched out, re-diverted the stream waters towards their diversion of sorts. But Mother Nature made it pretty nice and equal up there. And so I don't know. That's a whole other subject matter on that topic. County is direct, you know, responsibility is that bridge and then the park area and below the families that live along the stream. But there's contention about that, too. What families were helped? There's others that still have not received any help and things like that.
Which goes back to the issue of who gets what water rightfully.
True. So that's a state SeaWorm, Commission on Water Resource Management's take. And they've been here and there, but not really in the middle of it, trying to figure things out. They've been kind of hard to get a hold of, too. So that's another big question mark on that entity.
Which seems to go back to your whole issue that with so many question marks and so many people who are not at the table creating a comprehensive plan, that this seems to be ripe for even more trouble. Is this thing going to wind up in court?
I can't say on my behalf, but I wouldn't doubt something could go that way. I think people have a lot of huge concerns, and if it takes the courts and laws to be, you know, deciphered and figured out who's doing right or wrong, then so be it. But it has to be settled somewhere. It's not being settled within the government entities itself or the private, companies, landowners, whatever. It's just too much happening, and it is. It's, you know, kind of the shell game thing where come look over here, we're doing that. Oh, no, what, over there? No, not, we're not talking about that. We're talking about this. And it's just very confusing. Hard to cram in this 8-minute talk here, but there's a lot more going on.
What do you think that we especially need to know that we don't know?
I think people need to get the answers to what they need and definitely have our county be held accountable for what they've done and have straight up answers on what they can expect, you know, what we expect them to do moving forward in collaboration with people in the valley. Yes, and your cultural advisors. So it's important that people are all brought to the table and not be singled out and talked to one by one by one. Why can't we not have a big, collective, huge community outreach and lay it all out? Everyone ask all the questions they want and have every administration official there that can answer those questions, just so we can clear it once and for all and start moving forward in a collaborative, you know, comprehensive manner. And I think people will be happy and satisfied with that, but that the government needs to stick to their word on what they're laying out and the plan. They need to stick to it, and what they're telling us is what they're going to do, because it hasn't been seen.
All right. Well, we're going to wait and see how this continues to develop. As we've been talking about, surely this is going to be going on for quite some time. We'll check back with you and see how things are moving on Maui.
Right.
Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you for having me.
You too. Council member Ellie Cochran holds the West Maui seat and is currently serving a third term in office.
There's a reason swing-era music will never die. It's irresistibly danceable, geared toward creating a rhythmic pulse that all but drags people onto the dance floor. It also dates from a time when musicians were expected to be entertainers, reaching out to the audience with clever songs, witty patter, and good old showmanship. Kurt Sodergren plays drums and Andy Rowley plays baritone sax and sings in Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, a band that is very much at home in that tradition. They'll be performing at Blue Note Hawaii in Waikiki tonight through Sunday, and Kurt and Andy are with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Kurt, you were one of the guys who got the band started. What was the motivation?
Well, I met Scott when I first moved to Ventura in the late 80s, and we started playing together just as a duo, guitar and drums, and we had a pretty strong musical connection. So mm-hmm. we found a bass player, and we performed in a trio for about a year and a half playing roots music and blues. And then one day Scott said he wanted to start playing swing music, and this is right about the time that Nirvana was exploding, and my jaw dropped a little bit, I got to say. But yeah. I went for it because I wasn't really doing anything else. And
But you couldn't have been going in a more opposite direction.
Oh, yeah. I had no this. My grandpa played big band this whole life, so I had, I knew the music. I was really a big fan of Gene Krupa, but it wasn't something I really thought I was going to play. And so I started taking private lessons immediately to learn the style a little bit better. And we called Andy because we'd seen him around town sitting in with lots of bands playing his baritone sax. And we kind of just went for it. We grew up playing punk rock music, and the whole do-it-yourself ethos was strong. So we just gave it a shot, and we wrote the song Jumpin' Jack, and it was really, really fun. And we'd show up at a club, and we'd be dressed in vintage suits, and people would look at us like, what in the world is going on here? But we'd start playing, and even then Scott was still playing his Fender Strat out of a Marshall amp, so it was loud and very exciting.
It was painful.
Oh, yeah. He'd set his amp up right next to the drums, and I started putting a piece of wood on the back of it because the sound comes out both ends.
Oh, it sure does.
Yeah, so started wearing earplugs around that time. But it was always really, really exciting, and it just clicked with people. They really, really, really liked it.
It clicked with people because it gave them something they weren't getting anywhere else, don't you think?
I do. I know there were other bands playing that music, but not in our town. And I think there was little pockets, across the United States of bands starting to play that kind of music. It was the alternative to alternative music.
What drew you to these guys?
Well, I think the like for the same kind of music. Scott was saying, yeah, I really like, Louis Jordan. I've always loved that. Yeah. It's so fun. And like our conversation earlier, it brings a lot of fun and not so serious, but serious musicianship, but taking it lighthearted where it's fun and people actually feel invited to go dance and have fun and cut loose and enjoy each other. And it's, I think that's the job that it does. So I always love that kind of stuff. And I was in the moment he said, let's try this, because I was a big fan of his vocals. And so I had no problems jumping in. I think I was the only guy that he knew that had a saxophone at that time, too. So
it was more like if you have the football, you're going to be in the game.
Yeah, the jersey fits, you're on.
I wonder how many bands owe their existence to that very thing. I knew this guy who had a van, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's how we found our bass player, Dirk, because we knew we needed to get a stand-up bass. And I said, and Scott said, I think Dirk... This guy Dirk that does sound all around town, he had a PA and he would just do set up for people. But he said, I think he has an acoustic bass. So I got his number and I called it, and it was an answering machine message, and he was just playing his bass on the answering machine message. So I called Scott and said, call it. And so that was his audition, was listening to his outgoing message.
I love those stories about how bands get started, because it's frequently an unlikely story, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's fun. Yeah, because Scott and I actually had a musical connection we didn't even know about. I was going to school, and he was up in Ventura area doing music, and there's a mutual friend we had who was doing this recording project, and I would come up on a weekend and do some things and go back home. And so when I actually moved places, I was going through my albums, and I looked on the back of this record, and I realized, that's where the band had started. And I realized that Scott was on. I go, man, we played on the same record. I go, pulled it out. And he hadn't seen it in probably, 3-4 years. And I had no idea that we had done the same project without even knowing it.
That's how it works. And, you know, you spoke of the whole do-it-yourself ethos of that kind of punk era. And for a musician, that isn't really going to get you there to play swing. You have to add a lot of chops to do that, don't you?
Oh, certainly. That's why I jumped in and started taking lessons. And, you know, obviously we knew the music very well, but transforming it into for the crowd and playing it on your own. So we had a rehearsal room and we practiced all the time. And it was, we took it very seriously. And we had a van, and when we had a good amount of songs, we went in the studio and recorded our own CD, mm-hmm. and we'd sell that out of the van, and that would pay for gas. And we would just drive as far as we could get over the weekend and then come back and work the day job.
Just making sure you had enough gas to get you back home.
Yeah. Exactly. We didn't go too far. Just
I think that's actually how we chose our manager, because he had a Dodge Ram that was, you know, it ran, so he was in.
For big band drummers, you know, that's a style that you don't hear that much anymore. You know, Krupa, you mentioned Buddy Rich, guys like that. Joe Jones are great at driving a big engine, you know, having a bunch of musicians and making it all hold together. It's a different discipline, isn't it?
I think so. You know, you have a lot of responsibility. So that's why I took it seriously and took lessons, because, you know, you've got to set up the ensemble punches and you've got to keep a steady rhythm. And Gene Krupa was always a really big influence on me. But Sonny Payne, the way he would run Count Basie was mind-boggling.
Yeah. Well, that's that whole thing of, as you say, you keep the rhythm, but you've got all this intricate stuff happening from the horns, and you got to kick along with that.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah, and then the dynamics need to come up and down for solos. If it's a piano solo, obviously you're going to come down a lot and then bring the excitement up so that you can bring out the best solo in the soloist. So it's, you know, it's a lot of balls in the air.
The trick of bringing the volume down and the excitement up is kind of almost specific to that kind of music,
yeah,
too.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's to play along with that too as a horn player, to follow that too, really sets us up. He dedicates or the pulse. We got to follow that, and that really makes our job easier. And he's laid it down.
Make a setting for the jewel. Yeah,
exactly.
Great talking to both you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Kurt Sodergren plays drums. Andy Rowley plays baritone sax and sings in Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, which will be performing at Blue Note Hawaii in Waikiki tonight through Sunday. And you can find out more about the band on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Zulu man, feeling blue. Hear his heart beat, little tattoo. Singing digga-digga-doo, digga-doo-doo. Digga-digga-doo, digga-doo. Let those funny people smile. How can there be a virgin isle with digga-digga-doo, digga-doo-doo. Digga-digga-doo, digga-doo. Swing it.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
Ulanai, o mau, o ka ho'olawe, o Hawaii.
Are you ready for a flight around the world? Well, in today's Backyard Quiz, we're going to jump back into history and join Amelia Earhart. By the age of 23, she knew she wanted to fly. She became the 16th woman in the world to earn a pilot's license. In 1928, the famous pilot Charles Lindbergh asked Earhart to make a solo flight across the Atlantic, which she successfully completed. That accomplishment brought her international fame, and 5 years later, she attempted to be the first female pilot to fly around the world. We all know how that one ended, with one of the most mysterious disappearances in world history. That mystery actually began here in Hawaii, and our question today is, which airfield in Hawaii played a part in Earhart's fateful attempt to circumnavigate the world? Call our volunteers if you know, and feel free to make a pledge while you're at it. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The Honolulu voters may not love the rail project, but a Civil Beat poll says they want it done. Joining us with the data is reporter Chad Blair. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Now, we've seen intimations of this in the last several months as there have been, you know, other discussions about it, but you've quantified this in a new poll. What's the breakdown of those who say we've got to get it done to those who say not sure this is a good idea?
You know, it's a 2-to-1 margin. 61% of folks that we surveyed on Oahu, this was just a week or so ago, 2-to-1 margin say finish the darn thing, go all the way to Ala Moana Center. Only 29% said, well, maybe we should stop short. Of course, as we all know, we don't have the $1.8 billion to connect the Middle Street station to Ala Moana Center, but they still want to go all the way. I can tell you that about a third of the people that we surveyed said they thought rail was a bad idea to begin with.
Okay.
But another third said, well, it was a good idea initially, but we really haven't done very well. The execution has been poor. Only 14% said things are going well. I mean, you kind of wonder who those folks are, but only 14% say the rail line is making progress.
You know, it might be easy to say, gee, I want it to go all the way to Ala Moana, but the reality of it is we know we don't have enough money to be able to do that. So that backs us into another discussion about the GET, and already we've seen extensions to that. How okay were people with that continuing? And also, how did they feel about that 10% skim that the state gets?
Well, we did ask exactly that. When it comes to the skim, which, by the way, is estimated to be about $500 million over the course of the excise tax surcharge for the general excise tax, overwhelmingly folks said, yes, the state should give up that administrative fee and give it to the city, have it go to finish the rail line. This is something that Charles DeJoux and Kirk Caldwell agree on, and if either wins, almost certainly they will go back to the legislature and say, look, we'd like to renegotiate. We did also ask, well, should it come from just GET, or should we also maybe raise property taxes? And they were pretty clear on that. Most voters, or at least half of them, said, you know, maybe we have to extend the surcharge a little bit longer. Right now it goes to 2027. Maybe we need to go further. A much smaller number said, let's look at property taxes or some combination of the two.
Chad, as you looked at who was giving you these answers, can you give us a breakdown of maybe, you know, who was in the over 50 crowd and who was the under 50 crowd?
Well, you know, interestingly, across gender and age lines, it didn't seem to matter. A majority want to finish the rail line. Same with whites and Americans of Japanese ancestry. Didn't really make a difference at all. Some things stand out. People that made over $100,000, ironically, want the rail line done, although one might think they would be the people least likely to take the rail line. And DeJoux benefited more from people who were anti-rail, given his general view of the rail line. He's not anti-rail, but of course he has been strongly opposed to paying for it with excess taxes.
So the bottom line on this one is people want it. We're going to find the money to do it, and it's probably going to get finished at some point. Where that point is, we don't know.
You and I will still be talking about it, though.
Yeah, it gives us lots of fodder. Have a good rest of your day, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow, which we hope will be day 10 of this press drive and completing
hang in there.
It. Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Getting back to our backyard quiz, we're in the middle of an attempt to fly around the world with Amelia Earhart. Although people are aware of her mysterious fate, many don't know there was an incident in Hawaii that led to her changing her original route. Earhart's original westward-bound plan had her beginning in Oakland, California on March 17, 1937. From there, she flew west to Hawaii. On March 20th, she and her crew ran into issues during takeoff on the leg from Hawaii to Howland Island, the most difficult leg of the journey. The plane's landing gear collapsed and a wheel blew out. The damage would require drastic maintenance, taking 2 months to complete. Because the plane would not be fixed until summer, Earhart switched gears and rerouted her trip to fly east in the Northern Hemisphere. This time, they would begin in Miami on June 1, 1937. That crash took place on Oahu's Ford Island, and that's today's answer. If you've got a quiz you'd like to share with us about our backyard, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
It has been a week since Representative Bob McDermott filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of students at Campbell High School. The school, like many in Hawaii, is overcrowded. The cafeteria can only hold about 28% of the total student body. Representative McDermott has firsthand knowledge. Two of his kids attend the school, which may explain why he was willing to apply some legal pressure. Representative McDermott joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. It's an honor, and I'm humbled to be on public radio.
Well, thank you for making time for us this morning to talk about this. Now, the school has been crowded for a long time.
Right.
Why choose to do this now? Because here we are in an election year, and there are some who say, well, this is sort of grandstanding.
No. I've been working on the lawsuit probably for 8 months. When it became apparent that the legislature was not going to fund this school. Now, I share the school with two Democrats, so a Democrat senator and another Democrat House representative. So it's just not me, Republican, marginalized, can't get anything done. This school has been ignored by the legislature in an act of misfeasance, if you will. It's taken me this long to get the suit together because these things are expensive, and the research has to be done, and the things that I could do on my own, the research, enrollment numbers, projections, demographics, et cetera, I was able to do and reduce the cost. I would have filed it much sooner if I had the money, but I didn't have the money. That's the reality of it. Now, as far as grandstanding, my opponent is someone I beat by 20 points last time, so I feel fairly confident that this isn't that's not why I did it. I suppose some people will be cynical and think that's why I did it. But I've been talking to the neighborhood board about it for months, and they said after the session, well, what are you going to do now? The legislature didn't approve it. What are you going to do now? So I put my thinking cap on and said, okay, well, they're violating the state constitution because Article 10, Section 1 says the state is responsible for the physical facilities, and we are not taking care of those children.
Didn't the DOE give you some money, though, or at least budget some money, $12 million for the school?
So the governor asked for $35 million. The legislature cut that to 11. $35 million was for one building. So there's multiple issues at play here. One is this is the largest school in the state at 3,200 kids. My own child he went out for the football team and didn't make it. Not because he's not an athlete, he's a boxer now, but because they can only take 80 kids. And when you have a school that's three times the average enrollment in Oahu or in the state of Hawaii is 1,024 students. This school is three times larger. So children lose out in the opportunity to participate in extracurricular activities. The basketball team, for example, they take 15 kids. We will cut kids who can start on any other team in the state. Because just by the nature of the numbers. So you go to the cafeteria, the lunchroom, they can't hold all the kids. So kids
are perching wherever they can to be able to finish their meal in 30 minutes and then get back to class. So what have you heard from the DOE? Have they actually been physically served?
It's a legal matter now. They have 20 days to respond. And we will hear from their response then. I'm constrained by the only people I can sue is the governor, the BOE, and the DOE. My objective is to get a consent decree from them, like the Felix consent decree, where they agree to do certain things on timelines moving forward and fund them appropriately. The other issue involved here is the selection of the East Kapolei High School. We need another high school out here. Kapolei is overcrowded. Their children that they're taking are Campbell kids. They're the GEs they're taking are Campbell kids. So Kapolei and Campbell are both overcrowded. Campbell grossly overcrowded. and we need to build a new high school. Now, they've studied the sites, and they have four sites to choose from, and the site selection has been collecting dust since 2015.
Is there actually, are there actually funds that would be able to build a high school?
Well, $5 million has been released for planning and design. But you can't plan and design anything unless you select a site. So that's one of the things we asked for. The DOE's run like the Keystone Cops. I mean, it really is. They haven't selected a site yet. They have $5 million released for planning and design. But they can't design anything until they have a site, and they haven't selected a site.
With this being already now coming into the latter part of October, and it won't be until sometime earlier mid-November that you're going to hear back from the DOE.
Right.
And then we're coming into the holiday period, and pretty soon we're going to be looking at another legislative session.
Right.
There's some suggestion that, you know, this is something that should go back to the legislature, and that that's where the pressure should be applied, which I'm sure, you know, you plan to do anyway. But is there any sense of consensus with you and Matt Lopresti about how to go forward in this? Because, you know, clearly the overcrowding is not going to get taken care of this year, or maybe not even next year or the year after.
That's why I'm suing. I want to get a consent decree. I want them to agree to take care of the problem. Matt Lopresti, God bless him, is not going to say it. If you can research it, he hasn't said one word critical, because he's a Democrat, and it's his team that's screwing the kids of Campbell. He's a freshman. He has no juice. I'm a Republican. I have no juice. All I have is my voice to shine the light on misfeasance. He can't shine the light because he will be punished, literally punished. And by the way, House leadership has given him money for his reelection.
Okay, so not to politicize this too much, though.
All around town.
But not to politicize this, you know, too terribly much. You still have a lot of parents whose kids are the ones being overcrowded. Certainly they have a voice.
They do. And they're thanking me for taking action. One other thing that enters into this whole reason why there's no money for the new East Capilet and why there's no money for Campbell High School is they're building a high school in Kihei, Maui, where enrollment is declining, and they don't need a new high school. They want a high school because they say the kids have a 45-minute bus ride. Well, that's the mainland. Every kid has a 45-minute bus ride. We have exigent circumstances. We have an emergency in west Oahu, and people are turning a blind eye to it. And David Ige sold us that he was an engineer and would look at things deliberately and wouldn't put politics ahead of need. Well, this is a need, and the politicians, quite simply, should get out of dispersing CIP, because that's what the problem is the politicians carve up 70% of the money for their pet projects, and then 30% is left for the DOE to address their priorities, determined by professionals dealing with enrollment, projections, demographic changes, and all the rest.
Representative McDermott, I hate to cut you off, but the time is our master, and we have to leave you now. But thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you.
Hawaii State Representative Bob McDermott represents Eva Beach. We're going to keep watching that situation, and there will be many others, no doubt, that will flow from it, too, because we've watched many, many schools in Hawaii deal with overcrowding. But this one seems to be particularly huge. Now, tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the Hawaii Power Ballot and Charter Amendment 19. Corey Tanita from Common Cause will be here.
And we'll hear about Hawaii's first and only lightsaber academy.
We have a lightsaber academy?
So I'm told.
Oh, we're going to hear about that tomorrow. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And now we're going over to Pledge Central. I'm Chris Vandercook. We're joining Ray Cruz.